58. A Banquet of Friends. 7 men were seated around a festive table made by pushing 3 lockers of different heights together and covering them with a piece of bright green paper, another prize of war from Lawrence A.G. Sir Lockton and Rubin had joined Potapov on his bed. Abramson and Kondrashov sat by Prantchikov, and the birthday boy had made himself comfortable on the broad windowsill at the head of the table. Zemelya was already dozing up above, and the other neighbours were missing. The 2 double bunks, and the space between them, cut off from the rest of the room, were like a compartment in a train. Nadia's pastry straws, a confection never before seen in the Sharashka, were displayed on a plastic dish in the middle of the table, looking comically inadequate for 7 male mouths. Then there was ordinary cake and cake smeared with creme, dubbed accordingly patisserie. There was also creamy toffee, made by heating an unopened can of condensed milk. Behind Nyazhin's back lurked a dark liter jar containing the delectable something or other for which the wine glasses were intended. It was made from a few drops of spirits, obtained from the Zex in the chemical laboratory in return for a piece of quality, insulating material. This was diluted, 4 parts water to 1 part spirits, and then coloured with cocoa concentrate. The result was a brown liquid of low alcohol content, which was nonetheless impatiently awaited. "What do you say, gentlemen?" Sir Lockton, reclining picturesquely, his eyes shining even in the half-darkness of the closed compartment, had a suggestion. "Let's each try and remember when he last sat at a festive board." "Yesterday, with the Germans," Rubin growled. He couldn't stand sentimentality. Sir Lockton's occasional use of the word gentlemen in company was, Rubin thought, a sign that 12 years of imprisonment had addled his brain. It was impossible to believe that any man could pronounce the word seriously 32 years after the revolution. Sir Lockton had many other freakish notions, which could all be explained in the same way. Rubin tried to keep this in mind and not to flare up even when he found himself listening to something preposterous. Abramson, incidentally, thought Rubin's partying with the Germans no less weird. Internationalism was all very well, but there were limits. "No, no," Sir Lockton persisted. "I mean a real banquet, gentlemen." He was glad for any opportunity to use that proud form of address. Since so much more of the Earth's surface was reserved to the comrades, it was Sir Lockton's view that on the cramped islets where prison stood, those who did not like the word gentlemen must lump it. The marks of a real banquet are a rich, pale-complexioned tablecloth, wine in cut-glass decanters, and, needless to say, elegant women. He wanted to go on savouring the feast in anticipation, but Potapov inspected table and guests with a critical housewife's eye, and interrupted in his grumpy way.
"Listen, boys, before midnight strikes and the unsleeping watch descends to catch us with this poison, we'd better move on to the official part of the proceedings."
He gave Nyazhin the signal to pour. They were silent, but while the glasses were being filled, memories, welcome and otherwise, crowded in. "It's a long time ago," Nyazhin sighed. Potapov came out of his trance.
"So long, I just can't remember."
He had some vague recollection of somebody's wedding in the midst of a mad whirl of work before the war, but he could not be sure whether it was his own or one to which he had been invited. Prantchikov woke up.
"Well, if you can't, I can. Avec plaisir. Let me tell you about it. In Paris in 1945, I was—"
Potapov stopped him.
"Wait a bit, Valentulia. Let's just— to the friend in whose honour we are gathered here."
Kondrashov Ivanov pronounced the toast more loudly than was necessary, drawing himself up still straighter.
"May he be—"
But before the guests could reach for their glasses, Nyazhin raised himself slightly from the sill, there was barely room for him by the window, and said quietly,
"My friends, forgive this departure from tradition, but—"
He took a deep breath. He was agitated. The warmth beamed on him from 7 pairs of eyes had forged some purpose within him.
"Let us be fair. Not everything in our lives is black. We have, for instance, this form of happiness, the ease and freedom of high school conviviality. We can exchange thoughts freely, without fear or concealment. Were we so fortunate when we were free?"
"Well, we weren't free all that often,"
Abramson said with a laugh. Childhood apart, he had spent less than half his life at liberty.
Friends,
Nyazhin warmed to his theme.
I'm 31 years old. Life has pampered me at times and plunged me into the depths at others. In accordance with the law of sinusoidal motion, there may yet be sudden surges of hollow success and false greatness ahead of me. But I swear to you that I shall never forget that true human greatness that I have come to know in prison. I am proud that my modest anniversary today has brought together such a select company. Let's not embarrass ourselves with pompous speeches. Let's drink to the friendship that flourishes in prison vaults.
Paper cups soundlessly bumped glass and plastic. Potapov smiled apologetically, straightened his primitive spectacles, and, carefully spacing his words, recited,
"The sons of this illustrious clan, keen rhetoricians to a man, in anxious Nikita's house assembled, or where discreet Ilya dissembled."
They drank the brown beverage slowly, trying to define its bouquet.
"It's got a bit of a kick anyway,"
Reuben said approvingly.
"Bravo, Andreich!"
"It certainly has,"
Sologdin agreed. He was in a mood to praise anything today.
Nyazhin laughed. "A very rare occurrence. Lev and Mitya actually agree about something. I don't remember it happening before."
"Oh, yes, you do."
"No, Gleb, my friend. Don't you remember Lev and me agreeing around New Year's sometime that an unfaithful wife can't be forgiven, but an unfaithful husband can?"
Abramson laughed wearily.
"Good heavens! What male wouldn't say yes to that?"
"Well, that specimen over there,"
Reuben pointed at Nyazhin,
"maintained at the time that a woman could also be forgiven, that there was no difference." "You really said that?"
Kondrashov asked quickly.
Franchikov's laugh rang out. "What a nut! There's an enormous difference. The very structure of the body and the means of coupling show that there is an immense difference,"
Sologdin exclaimed.
"No, it goes deeper than that,"
Reuben protested.
"It's part of nature's grand design. A man is more or less indifferent to quality in women, but has an instinctive appetite for quantity. Thanks to that, few women are completely overlooked."
Sologdin raised his hand in a graceful gesture of acknowledgement.
"Hence," he said, "the charitable character of Don Juanism."
"Well, then, women hanker after quality, if you want to put it that way."
Kondrashov wagged a long finger.
"Their unfaithfulness is a quest for quality. That way their progeny is improved."
Nyazhin defended himself.
"Don't blame me, friends. Look, when I was growing up, there were red banners flapping overhead with equality in golden letters." "Equality? Since when, of course? Oh, no, not equality again,"
Sologdin growled. "What have you got against equality?"
Abramson looked indignant. "Nothing, except that it doesn't exist in the natural world. People are not born equal. That's a myth invented by those idiots, those know-it-alls."
You had to guess that he meant the encyclopedists.
"They had not the least understanding of heredity. People are born unequal spiritually, unequal in willpower, unequal in ability."
"Unequal in possessions, unequal in social status,"
Abramson took up the tale, mimicking Sologdin.
"Well, where did you ever see equality of possessions? Where did you ever manage to create it?"
Sologdin was getting heated.
"There never was such a thing, and there never will be. It's unattainable except by beggars and saints."
Nyazhin interrupted before the argument could become a quarrel.
"Since then, life has hammered a bit more sense into my stupid head, of course. But in those days I thought if nations are equal and human beings are equal, surely men and women must also be equal. In all respect. Nobody's blaming you."
Kondrashov's eyes were as emphatic as his words.
"Don't give in too soon. These delusions of yours are pardonable only on account of your youth,"
Sologdin ruled. He was 6 years older.
"Theoretically, Gleb is right,"
Reuben said hesitantly.
"I'm ready to break 100,000 lances myself for the equality of men and women. But embrace my wife after somebody else has embraced her? Brr! It's a biological impossibility.
If you ask me, gentlemen, it's ridiculous even talking about it,"
Pranchikov piped. But, as usual, he wasn't allowed to have his say.
"There's a simple solution, Lev Grigorievich,"
Potapov said firmly.
"You yourself mustn't embrace anyone except your wife." "Well, you know how it is."
Rubin made a gesture of helplessness, and a broad smile lost itself in his piratical beard. The door opened noisily, and somebody came in. Potapov and Abramson looked around. No, it wasn't the guard.
"What about it?"
"Delenda est Carthago."
Abramson nodded toward the liter jar.
"The sooner the better. Who needs a spell in solitary? Come on, Vikentich, pour."
Nilshin poured out what was left, scrupulously ensuring that the shares were equal.
"Maybe you'll allow us to drink a birthday toast now?" Abramson asked.
"No, brothers. As it's my birthday, I shall claim one privilege, to break with tradition. I saw my wife today, and in her I saw all our tormented, terrorized, and persecuted wives. We put up with our lot because there's no escape. But what about them? Let's drink to those who have voluntarily shackled themselves. Yes, to those heroines,"
Kondrashov Ivanov exclaimed. They drank, and were silent for a while.
"Look at the snow," Potapov remarked.
They all looked round. Behind Nyazhin, beyond the misted windows, the snow itself could not be seen, but they glimpsed a flurry of black shadows of snowflakes cast on the prison windows by the lamps and searchlights in the grounds. Somewhere beyond the curtain of that copious snowfall there were people, and Nadia Nyazhina was one of them.
"We're even fated to see the snow as black, not white,"
Kondrashov exclaimed.
"We've drunk to friendship, we've drunk to love. These are fine things, timeless things,"
Rubin said.
"As far as love is concerned, I never had any doubt about it. But to tell the truth, before I served at the front and then landed in prison, I didn't believe in friendship, especially the sort that, you know, that makes you lay down your life for a friend. In the normal course of things, a man has his family, and that leaves him no room for friendships. Am I right?"
"That's a view widely held," Abramson replied. "There's a song you often hear, played by request on the radio, 'I Tread the Valley's Even Path.' Just pay attention to the words. It's one long, nauseating whine, the self-pitying moan of a mean spirit. Friends are friends, and comrades faithful, only till the dark days come." The artist was outraged.
"It wouldn't be worth living a single day longer if you thought like that. Might as well hang yourself."
"It's just the opposite, really. Friendship begins when the dark days come."
"Who wrote it, anyway?"
"Merzlyakov."
"What a name. Who's Merzlyakov, Liev, old man?" "Poet, born 20 years before Pushkin. You know his biography, of course. Professor at Moscow University. Translated Tasso."
"Is there anything Lev doesn't know, except higher mathematics?"
"Yes, elementary mathematics.
He keeps on saying, 'Let's open the brackets,' and he thinks the square of a negative number is negative."
Prantikov butted in, sputtering in his eagerness to be heard like a child at table with adults.
"Gentlemen, I feel bound to show you that Merzlyakov was sometimes right."
He was in no way inferior to his companions. He had a quick mind, was witty and engagingly frank. But he lacked the self-control and composure of a grown man, so that he seemed 15 years younger than they were, and they treated him like an adolescent.
"It's a proven fact. The man who eats out of the same dish is the one who betrays you. I had a close friend. He and I escaped from a Nazi concentration camp and hid from search parties together. Later on, I got into the family of a big businessman, and he was introduced to a French countess."
"Really?" said Sologdin, impressed. Titles like Count and Prince still held an irresistible charm for him.
"There's nothing surprising in that. Some Russian prisoners of war even married marchionesses."
"You don't say."
"Well, when Colonel General Galikov began his repatriation swindle, I wouldn't go, of course. In fact, I did my best to talk the other Russian idiots out of it, and suddenly I met this best friend of mine. And just imagine, he was the one who betrayed me, gave me up to the Jeebies."
"What a wicked thing,"
the artist exclaimed.
"Let me tell you how it was."
They were nearly all listening to Prantchikov's story now. But Sologin wanted to know how POWs came to marry countesses. To Rubin it was quite clear that the jolly and amiable Valentulia, with whom it was perfectly possible to be friendly in the Sharashka, had, looked at objectively, been a reactionary figure in Western Europe in 1945, and that what he called treachery on the part of a friend, meaning that the friend had assisted Prantchikov to return involuntarily to his native land, was not treachery, but the friend's patriotic duty. One story led to another. Potapov remembered the booklet that was handed to every repatriate, "The Motherland Forgives, the Motherland Calls." It said in black and white that the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet had ruled against the prosecution even of repatriates who had served in the German police. These elegantly produced, profusely illustrated booklets, with their nebulous hints at unspecified adjustments to the collective farm system and the social order in the Soviet Union, were confiscated during the search at the frontier, while the repatriates themselves were put into prison trucks and dispatched to counter-espionage headquarters. Potapov had read one of these booklets with his own eyes, and although it had nothing to do with his own decision to return, he found this dirty little trick on the part of an enormous state peculiarly distressing. Abramson was dozing behind his staring glasses. He had known that there would be all this silly talk. How else could the regime have rounded up that mob? Rubin and Nyazhin had both spent the first year after the war in counter-espionage depots and jails, immersed in the stream of POWs flowing in from Europe. They felt as if they had themselves endured four excruciating years in captivity, and they were no longer particularly interested in the stories of repatriates. Instead, they joined in persuading Kondrashov to talk about art. Rubin regarded Kondrashov as a mediocre artist and not very serious person, whose views were divorced from economic and historical reality. Yet, whenever they conversed, without realizing it himself, Rubin drank in the artist's words like living water. Art, to Kondrashov, was not just an occupation or a branch of knowledge. It was the only possible way of life. All that he saw around him, landscapes, objects, people, colors, evoked one of the 24 tonalities. Rubin was labeled C minor. All that he heard or felt, a human voice, the mood of a moment, a novel, a tonality, had a color, and Kondrashov could tell you without hesitation what it was. The key of F-sharp major was dark blue and gold. There was one state of mind Kondrashov had never experienced, indifference. He made no secret of his immoderate likes and dislikes. He was famous for his uncompromising judgments. He was a devotee of Rembrandt and a debunker of Raphael, an admirer of Valentin Serov, and fiercely hostile to the itinerant school. He was incapable of qualified approval. For him there was no midpoint between boundless enthusiasm and boundless indignation. He could not stand Chekhov. He was repelled by Tchaikovsky. "He suffocates me. He robs me of hope and the will to live." But felt such an affinity with Bach's chorales and Beethoven's concertos that he might have composed them himself. "Must pictures be true to nature?" was the subject for discussion this time. "Well, suppose you want to depict a window opening onto a garden on a summer morning," Kondrashov said. His voice was youthful, with an occasional shrill note when he was excited. "If you closed your eyes, you might think you were listening to an adolescent arguing. If you faithfully copy nature, if you depict it all just as you see it, will it really be all? What about the singing of the birds, the freshness of the morning, the purity of the scene? While you are painting, you are aware of these things. They enter into your experience of the summer morning. But how are you to preserve them in the picture? How can you avoid denying them to the viewer? Obviously, you have to find some substitute for them, using the only resources you have, color and composition. So you can't just copy?" "Of course not. And anyway..." Kondrashov was beginning to get carried away. "You begin every landscape and every portrait by admiring nature and thinking how marvelous, how fine. If only I could show it just like that, just as it is. But you get deeper into your work, and suddenly you realize, just a minute, hang on, so much for nature. This is simply absurd, just nonsense, completely incongruous. Look here, for instance, and here.
It ought to be like this, and like that. That's how you paint.
Kondrashov looked triumphantly and challengingly at his companions.
Yes, but ought to be takes you down a very dangerous road, old man,
Rubin protested.
You'll find yourself making angels and devils out of flesh and blood people, which, in fact, is just what you do. Say what you like. If you paint a portrait of Andrei Andreevich Potapov, it ought to be Potapov.
But what does portraying him as he really is mean?
Kondrashov protested.
There must, of course, be an external resemblance. Same facial proportions, same shape eyes, same colour hair. But isn't it rather rash to suppose that we can see reality just as it is? Especially spiritual reality. Who can see that or know it? And if I look at a sitter and discern in him qualities finer than those he has so far revealed, why shouldn't I make so bold as to depict them? Help the man find himself and rise to higher things.
Nielsen clapped his hands.
Why, you're a 100% socialist realist. The deputy minister doesn't know what a treasure he has in you. Why should I undervalue his soul?
Kondrashov's glasses, immovably fixed to his nose, flashed angrily in the half-darkness.
Let me tell you, the most important thing about portrait painting, and indeed about all relationships, is that whatever one person sees and identifies in another is evoked and activated in that other person. Understand?
In short, Rubin said dismissively, objectivity means nothing to you, in this as in other things.
Yes, indeed. I'm unobjective and proud of it,
Kondrashov thundered. Rubin was taken aback.
Eh? Eh? What's that you say?
You heard. I'm proud of being unobjective.
Kondrashov's words were like the blows he might have struck if the upper bunk had not cramped his swing.
What about you, Lev Grigorievich? What about you? You are unobjective, too, but consider yourself objective, and that's much worse. That's where I'm superior. I'm unobjective, and I know it. I take credit for it. That's the essential me.
Not objective? Me?
Rubin seemed astonished.
If I'm not objective, who on earth is?
Nobody,
the artist cried exultantly.
Nobody at all. Nobody ever was, and nobody ever will be. In fact, every cognitive act has an emotional colouring, has it not? The truth that is destined to be the end result of long inquiries is surely dimly present in our minds before our inquiries even begin. We pick up a book feeling a vague antipathy for the author. We foresee before we have read the first page that we will pretty certainly not like it. And of course we don't. You've embarked on a comparison of 100 of the world's languages. You've only just finished lining up your dictionaries. There's 40 years of work ahead of you, but you're already sure that you'll succeed in proving that all words derive from a word for hand. Do you call that objectivity?
Nerzhin, highly gratified, roared with laughter at Rubin. Rubin laughed, too. How could anyone be angry with this holy innocent? Kondrashov had not mentioned politics, but Nerzhin was quick to do so.
Go one step further, Ippolit Mikhailich. Just one, I beg you. What about Marx? I feel sure that before he had begun his economic analyses or compiled any statistical tables, he knew in advance that under capitalism the working class faces absolute impoverishment, that it is the best part of mankind, and hence that the future belongs to it. Hand on heart, Lev. Isn't that the truth?
Rubin sighed.
My dear friend, if we could never foresee what we were going to find,
you see, Ippolit Mikhailich, and that is what they base this progress of theirs on. How I hate that meaningless word, progress. Well, in art there is no progress. There can be none.
Nerzhin was delighted.
No, indeed. Indeed, there isn't. That's what's so good about it. The 17th century had Rembrandt, and Rembrandt's still here. Just try and go one better today. Whereas 17th century technology seems primitive to us now. Or think of the great inventions of the 1870s. To us, they look like children's toys. Yet those were the years in which Anna Karenina was written. If you know of anything finer, I would like to hear about it.
Rubin seized his opening.
Hold on there, maestro. You do at last leave us with some progress in engineering.
You don't call that meaningless.
Anyway, Gleb Vikentich, Abramson put in, your argument can be turned inside out. It can be taken to mean that scientists and engineers have done great things over the centuries and made progress, while the art snobs have obviously just been playing the fool. Parasites.
In it for the money, Sir Logdon exclaimed.
He seemed pleased about it. He and Abramson, poles apart, were allies for the space of a single thought. Priyantchikov applauded.
Bravo, bravo, well done, boys. That's just what I was trying to tell you yesterday in the acoustics lab.
He had been talking about the superior merits of jazz, but it seemed to him now that Abramson was expressing his own thoughts for him.
I think I can make peace between you,
Potapov laughed knowingly.
There has been, in the course of this century, one historically well-attested occasion on which a certain electrical engineer and a certain mathematician, painfully aware of a lacuna in the belles lettres of their fatherland, jointly composed a short piece of fine writing. Alas, it was never written down. They had no pencil.
Andreich, cried Nyazhin, couldn't you reconstruct it?
With a bit of a struggle and your help. It was my one and only opus. So I ought to be able to remember it.
Gentlemen, this is going to be fun.
Sir Logdon brightened and settled himself more comfortably. Jeux d'esprit of this sort were the thing he really enjoyed in prison.
But you surely realize that, as Lev Grigorievich teaches us, no work of art can be understood unless we know the history of its creation and the social requirement it meets. You're improving, Andreich. So, dear guests, eat up the cake that was made for you. The story of its creation is as follows. In the summer of the year 1946, in a hideously overcrowded cell in the nursing home called Bouture, the administration had stamped that inscription, meaning Bouturskaya Tyurma, Butyrki prison, on the crockery. Gleb and I were lying side by side under the bedplanks to begin with, then on the bedplanks, gasping for air, groaning from hunger, and we had nothing to occupy ourselves with except light conversation and observation of behaviour. I'm not sure which of us said it first.
What if you did, Andreich? You said, what if... In any case, the key image from which the piece takes its title certainly belongs to you.
Well, Gleb and I asked ourselves, what if... What if suddenly into our cell...
Don't tease. What did you call it?
All right, all right. Let's try and remember that ancient tale between us, shall we?
Potapov's voice, cracked and muffled, was like that of an inveterate devourer of dusty folios.
Its title was The Buddha's Smile.